Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, who's a professor of political science and East Asian languages and cultures at Indiana University, where he directs the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships. His books include The Business of Lobbying in China, China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization, and he's currently at work on two projects that focus on Chinese participation in international economic regimes and in placing the Chinese political economy in comparative perspective. His latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And there's been a fairly acrimonious exchange between the U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Lieutenant General Wang Guozhang, who's a deputy chief of the General Staff of the People's Liberation Army. They have been in Singapore, where they've been having the annual Shangri-La dialogue, where they're all supposed to get together, the military leaders of all the countries in the region and other leaders as well. But instead of this being a Shangri-La, it's turned into quite a nasty exchange with between the Chinese general and the U.S. Defense Secretary and the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. So is that an indication of how this relationship is getting rocky?
Absolutely. This is following on several months of some tense issues related to the South China Sea and the East China Sea, various border disputes. We're also at a politically sensitive time in China, given the upcoming anniversary of June 4th. And, you know, domestically, U.S. policy toward China and our overall foreign policy, the Obama administration has not done a very good job of articulating its vision or implementing it. And so a variety of different factors are probably what generated a lot of the heat and controversy in Singapore in the past few days.
Well, you have Chuck Hagel accusing China of destabilizing Asia. And then on the other side, you have the Chinese general accusing the U.S. and Japan of incitement. So it looks as though they're talking past each other.
Most definitely. They have very different views for what the Asia-Pacific should look like in terms of security architecture, you know, contrasted with Europe following World War II, where you had NATO, very clear, complex alliance structure. In East Asia, you basically had the United States at the center of an axis with relationships with Japan, the Philippines, Korea, but no institutionalized architecture. And as the Cold War wound down and China has become much more powerful, there's been no real institutionalized mechanisms in the region to deal with this changing balance of power in a way that would be relatively systematic. And the Shangri-La meeting is one of those areas where we do. But essentially, these are all talk shops. And sometimes the talk, as you can see, can get quite heated.
So in terms of what has sparked this protest, we'll get to Tiananmen in a minute, but has sparked this protest in the South China Sea and this acrimony at the meeting in Singapore was the Chinese putting an oil rig in Vietnamese waters. And that led to protests in Vietnam and the burning of a lot of Chinese businesses, et cetera. China, of course, is incredibly energy hungry. So how much... You know, how much are we exaggerating their hegemonic? Because my understanding is that if they're hegemonic, they're more hegemonic in terms of the economy than they are in terms of the military.
Sure, I think you're absolutely right. But certainly, China has ambitions to become the dominant power in Asia, including supplanting the U.S., who currently holds that role. But this is a long-term game the Chinese are playing. I think at the moment what they've been trying to do is, yes, they have long-term ambitions and believe the places where they've put that oil rig and the rest of the South China Sea is Chinese sovereign waters and territory. But that's obviously highly contested. And the relationship with Southeast Asia and elsewhere is being strained because they thought they had come to essentially an agreement where they wouldn't do anything provocative. And certainly the Chinese have done that. And I think probably what's got them doing that is one, you have a leader in Xi Jinping who's probably a little bit more nationalistic and a little bit more assertive than his predecessors. And two, you have the United States foreign policy establishment really unclear and ambiguous about what the U.S. role in the world is going forward, including in the Asia Pacific, where for the past few years they've announced that the U.S. is engaged in a pivot toward the region. Yet in the speech that President Obama gave at West Point last Wednesday, he barely mentioned China and Southeast Asia. He put them in the context of this hard to make sense of rules of the road part of his speech. But he didn't focus on the region specifically. And so I think the Chinese are testing the U.S. To see what their resolve is, and what they're finding is that the Obama administration is not very clear about really what is extremely important to them and what's not.
And Scott Kennedy, you were in China recently. What's your sense of what's going on with the Communist Party leadership in their crackdown, their preemptive crackdown on any possible dissent? They've been jailing scholars and activists and warning Western journalists to stay away from Tiananmen Square in the coming days.
Sure. Well, China is, as always, one of the most complicated places to understand, not only just because it's such a large country with a long history, but also there's so many different strands at any one moment. And at the same time that they are arresting folks and looking like they're on pins and needles, as well as, you know, putting more police in subways and issuing these warnings, it's also a place still, you know, surprisingly, despite all the headlines that this is accurately making, it's still a place of a tremendous dynamism where there's also big debates about the country's future, particularly on economic and social issues, where philanthropy, another area I've been paying a lot of attention to, has been growing really rapidly. And so at the same time that you're seeing all of this tension, you're seeing all of these other things as well. And so I think I don't think that this is a regime worried about being toppled. I don't think that they're worried about a color revolution, but they are worried about substantial potential levels of violence directed against them, which they would find could spin out of control. I think they feel relatively secure in terms of overall popular support or the ability of the coercive apparatus to deal with those that aren't in favor of the regime. But at the tactical level, you're definitely seeing the screws turn quite severely.
And it seems to me that the Chinese communist regime, since Tiananmen, where you know those protests erupted over the death of Hu Yongbao, who was a very popular leader with the students, and because the president Zhao Zheng seemed to be more sympathetic to the students and give them a lot of rope, and you know they were able to go on television and basically harangue the leadership. This was unprecedented in China, and it just got to the point where the hardliners couldn't tolerate it anymore, and they cracked down in that brutal way. And ever since then, it seems like they've sort of substituted any democratic aspirations, particularly amongst the students, and replaced that by encouraging nationalism. Is that your reading on what's happened since?
I think that's certainly part of it. They have, I think, overall, the regime decided that if they had, at least the conservatives, thought that allowing the protesters to push toward regime change at that point would have led to a chaotic situation that may have created more freedom but wouldn't have addressed China's other problems related to its economy and society and station in the world. And that is certainly an argument which they pull out again and again over the last 25 years to say, look, yes, we've kept things very tight politically, but compare us to any other regime, communist or otherwise, in terms of economic growth and development over that period, and you'll find that we've been relatively successful. Now, that's got a lot of value in that argument. It's not entirely wrong. At the same time, the reading of history is certainly shaped by their own preferences. At the same time, you know, at sort of small types of democracies, which we're not talking about competitive elections for national office, but in terms of people's personal lives, their choice of career, their ability to travel, you know, 100 million Chinese traveled abroad last year, the amount of complexity in society and the development of NGOs and other types of things certainly is still continued. So again, it's a complex place in which, you know, in terms of big politics and big D, yes, nothing's changed and it's gotten tighter. But in terms of at the social level, still an immense amount of dynamism.
And of course, the Chinese have tried to thwart that because one of the main avenues for this dynamism has been the internet, which they've controlled in a way that's unprecedented, certainly would be unprecedented over here. But looks as though Putin is borrowing from the Chinese model and doing what he can. He's pretty much taking control of the internet in Russia after having taken control of all of the media except for one newspaper. And then they've just signed a deal. So is there any sense when you're in China that the Chinese are looking towards a sort of a compact with Russia and Iran, you know, a kind of rejectionist compact against the American hegemon?
I think that we don't need to go too far down the road of thinking that we are returning to the type of relationship and pattern that we faced during the Cold War with the Soviets and Chinese on one side, with other smaller communist countries or rejectionists, and the U.S. and its allies on the other. Certainly, there's elements of that, but the Chinese and Russians still have an extremely complex relationship and competitive in many ways. The deal that they signed, the 30-year deal they signed for natural gas last week, it was interesting that none of the details of that deal were announced, which suggests to me that they've not worked the details out. Even though the Russians clearly are borrowing from the Chinese playbook now on certain things, I don't expect us to be stepping toward the old Cold War style or even a hot one. There's many ways that the U.S. and China share common interests, not the least of which is economic. And so I think what we need is a much better diplomacy and foreign policy from our side to make sure that we don't go down the road which we seem to be heading, at least in the short term.
So we need to bring back Nixon and Kissinger, right?
they probably do a little bit better than the current group. You know, I think the Obama administration actually started off on a pretty good foot in his first term, and they had a pretty clear idea of where China and Asia fit in the overall shape of their foreign policy. And in the last few years, despite what I think has been improved rhetoric about the need to pivot and refocus attention on Asia, in fact, it's been very minor. Yes, there's the push for the Trans-Pacific Partnership and greater discussion of security issues bilaterally and multilaterally. But really, it's really still unclear what our ultimate goals are and how our relationship with China is going to evolve over time. And in terms of day-to-day management, we just keep running into these headaches. And I think we just need greater focus and attention and clarity. And the speech that President Obama gave at West Point, I don't think did him well in laying out where we ought to be heading.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I'm happy to speak with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's a professor of political science and East Asian languages and cultures at Indiana University, where he directs the Research Center on Chinese Politics and Business. He has his books include The Business of Lobbying in China, China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.